Welcome to Reboot Republic. Just myself here now. Rory had to leg it, but what you're going to hear now is a short conversation with UN Special Rapporteur for Housing, Lilani Farah, who was kind enough to join us on the podcast for the third time. This time she was travelling in South Africa for a conference where they were looking at how housing is one of the main drivers of global inequality. Lilani talks about the solutions, what governments need to be doing, and we also discuss in some detail the Irish situation and some of the things that we should, the pressures that and obligations that the state need to live up to. Again, quick reminder, we really need your support to keep doing these podcasts. They don't get made without time, effort and a lot of opportunity cost. If you could give us the price of a cup of coffee, head over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack. The podcasts are sponsored by you. We can't make them without it. But without further ado, this is myself, Rory, and UN Special Rapporteur Lilani Farah. Thanks for listening.
Lilani, thanks so much for joining us on the podcast.
Happy to be here.
And you're in South Africa. What are you doing there?
I'm in Durban, South Africa. There's this huge congress going on, a gathering of cities from around the world, local governments from around the world. And they have some political process going on about sort of who's going to be head of this entity called UCLG, United Cities and Local Governments. But there's a huge number of workshops and presentations and interactive sessions going on all about cities, and some are even about human rights and housing.
Very good. And I know I see that you're launching, or you're talking about there, the guidelines that you have done around kind of what should governments and local authorities and city councils do if they actually want to implement a right to housing.
Yeah, that's right. So one of the things I've realized as rapporteur in the last 5.5 years is that I think at this point, most governments at different levels kind of have a sense that there is a problem. I think it's recognized now there is a global housing crisis. Unaffordability is a key issue, as is homelessness, forced evictions and evictions, and the rise of informal settlements and encampments and tent cities and, you know, people living in their cars and that kind of thing. So I think we're at a stage now where it's okay, we all agree there's this global housing crisis. What I find is when I meet with governments, they kind of don't know what to do about it. Where there is concern, they don't know what to do about it. And so I thought, as my swan song as rapporteur, I would develop a set of guidelines on the implementation of the right to housing. So the guidelines aren't minutiae about housing policy and programs, because every country is going to have to come up with those policies and programs on their own. What it does instead is it provides the foundation for those policies and programs. So if you were to lay this human rights foundation, you would end up with policies and programs that actually implement the right to housing. That's the main aim of the guidelines. Mm. So we talk about things like, you know, the necessity of ending homelessness immediately because it's an egregious violation of the right to housing and the right to life. We talk about the need to legislate the right to housing, either in constitutions or in legislation, and that is absolutely essential to moving forward and implementing the right to housing. Stuff like that.
And in terms of, just before we go into a bit more details of, you know, what's in there and what you're kind of recommending, you also obviously, you know, are in The Push, the movie, documentary about kind of the rise of financialization investors and this kind of global housing crisis. And it was in Ireland recently, and I saw it, and it was, you know, an excellent, excellent documentary where you play a starring role. And I think one of the things that was interesting to me, kind of, and looking at this, like, you talk about a global housing crisis, you know, there's always been housing crisis. What's different about it now? Is it quantitatively different, or are people being affected differently, or what's different?
Yeah, I think you're right that there's long been housing crises in different parts of the world, different cities. I think one thing that is different is the global nature of this. In the north and the south, we're seeing the same patterns, which is really unaffordability, where rental accommodation where it's available is skyrocketing in price, and income and wages are stagnating. And so there's this huge gap between income and the cost of housing. And that cost of housing is being driven by a whole new set of actors that have really come onto the housing scene, really invaded the housing scene since 2008 in the global financial crisis, which is really actually somewhat nauseating, actually, if you think about it, because they used the global financial crisis as a vehicle to grow their own wealth. And these financial actors are hedge funds, private equity firms. I know folks in Ireland know well who these actors are, because Ireland is one of the most affected countries, and Dublin, one of the most affected cities in the world. But this is unprecedented. It's unprecedented in terms of the amount of wealth that is both being put into housing and that is being extracted out of residential real estate. And the numbers and the figures are really crazy and like never before. So we're talking, you know, the global value of residential real estate is now $163 trillion, which is, you know, more than two times, almost three times the value of GDPs across the world taken together, right? Yeah. All of the world's GDPs. So this is like big business, the biggest business of all businesses. And so this is new territory. And I mean, really the havoc that they're wreaking is unbelievable. They're really going after what they call undervalued properties, which we would call, or I would call, properties where people are actually able to afford the rent. So they're gobbling those up, purchasing them. They're doing minor renovations, unnecessary renovations, cosmetic upgrades, and then driving up the prices and the rents of those units and then making them unaffordable. People are self-evicting or being evicted because they can't afford the rent. And then a whole new class of people are moving in, leaving those tenants left with nowhere to go. They're either living, you know, often having to live in homelessness, living in cars, or being driven right out of the city and their own communities.
What we've seen, you're right to reference Dublin as majorly impacted by this. And it's interesting that you use the word extraction, because what we've seen now, even in the limited way we're tackling this here domestically, is we've seen land value extraction, you know, quadruple. So even people who are saying, well, like they can build a home for 180,000, then ends up being called an affordable house of 360,000. And we've seen the definition of affordable housing change from the cost of actually producing the home plus a builder's margin to the market rate less 20%. And this was actually been changed by our own government. This, you know, they changed the definition, and it's resulting in, now we say, well, oh, these are affordable homes, but they don't meet any international standard of what actual affordable housing is. And, you know, I can only say, looking around the world and talking things like Hong Kong and these events, housing insecurity is at the root of a lot of these movements. Have you found that?
Yeah. I'm so glad you said that. That's been my feeling, and my there's evidence to suggest that if you look at Chile, if you look at Lebanon, if you look at Hong Kong, for sure, at the root of this is, yes, inequality, but we have to ask, or income inequality, as it's called, what drives income inequality? And I am quite convinced that real estate and the way it's being treated is a main driver of inequality. And I mean, if you look at Chile in particular, which has the sort of a very well-known, very neoliberal approach to everything, and has since the Pinochet years. I mean, Pinochet was very friendly with Milton Friedman. I mean, you know, they embraced neoliberalism really before anyone else.
And they were the test case.
Including Margaret Thatcher, in fact. And their entire housing model is based on that. And so what you have are a lot of very discontent households living on the periphery of Santiago, the, you know, main city in Chile, the capital, living on the margins with no way to access employment. The housing itself is in poor quality, was never built well to begin with. And of course, that's going to foment feelings of anger and frustration, and it's going to drive inequality. You have people with money living in the city center and able to make money because they have access to employment. Mm. And you have disenfranchised people living on the outskirts of the city. Oh, and the depth of poverty increasing every day, you know? So that's just one example. I mean, the same thing in Lebanon, you see, I mean, it's well known in Lebanon that there's a housing crisis there. And Beirut, for example, city center is deserted with all of these half-built buildings and all of this stuff. You know, and Hong Kong, of course, is the most expensive housing market in the world. So to not attribute the unrest and the inequality to real estate and housing, I think would be a mistake.
What do you think then in terms of your guidelines, what do you think governments should do? And look, and
municipalities. Yeah, well, I mean, the big thing is to recognize housing as a human right. And the flip of that is to recognize tenants, people living in homelessness, as rights holders. And that's a game changer, in my opinion, because then you no longer look at that population as, you know, whatever, recipients of charity. Mm. You have to look at them as people with entitlements. And the entitlement is to adequate housing and for that to be progressively realized. And so that's the big first step that I am hoping governments will take. And I'm starting to see some pretty cool action around the world at both national and city level. So, you know, you have governments of Canada, Portugal, and now Mexico. These are just examples, adopting rights-based housing strategies. And, you know, that's a huge step. In the case of Canada, which is where I'm from, and I admit I might have had a hand in some of this.
of course.
Not only did they adopt, yes, well, one would hope so, right? But not only did they adopt a rights-based housing strategy, this is a country that has since the mid-1990s been very vocal that housing is not a human right. It should not be considered a justiciable right. In other words, you shouldn't be able to claim this right. You can't claim this right anywhere. In a court, no way. You know, a tribunal, forget it. That's been their position since the mid-1990s. In June of this year, of 2019, they adopted legislation that says that Canada's housing policy understands that and is based in the idea, the concept that housing is a fundamental human right protected in international human rights law. So this is a huge shift that, you know, a Western developed nation has made, and I think sets a very good example for other countries. Portugal as well. I mean, it wasn't such a huge shift for Portugal. They've had the right to housing in their constitution for a long time now, but it was never actionable. And now they're making it actionable through a new basic law on housing. So I'm feeling that there's some movement, and certainly at the city level, a lot of cool stuff is happening. City of Barcelona, Mayor Colau really moving on the right to housing, Berliners taking to the streets, and the Mayor Mueller really responding to that. And there's been a real push to recognize housing as a human right through all of their actions. So, you know, I'm kind of hopeful that we're moving along, but that's what the guidelines are for, is to make this kind of acceptable, to make it seem as easy and straightforward as it actually is, and then to produce some results.
Can I bring that? I know I hear what you're saying. Berlin, the example was really good in terms of what they did in terms of taking, you know, public ownership of some of the rental units and these things where they were looking at. I know also I saw the things around Canada, but from an Irish perspective, what we've seen is, I think, a growth of about 452% in child homelessness. And to, you know, to talk about that just briefly, you know, first and foremost, is that in breach of the UN Article 27, child homelessness, the right to housing? You know, are we not living up to our obligations under international law?
Well, look, I haven't done an official mission to Ireland. As you know, I was there for 48 hours on an unofficial visit, but an amazing visit nevertheless. So I'm not really in a position to judge the government of Ireland and its status vis-a-vis its obligations under international human rights law. That being said, I can't, you know, we know homelessness is an egregious violation of the right to housing and a violation of human rights. We know this. And governments know this. And it's certainly inconsistent with the government's political commitment to the Sustainable Development Goals. Goal 11, Target 11.1 says that everyone should have access to affordable, adequate, and secure housing. Homelessness obviously doesn't meet that commitment. And so obviously it's a real concern to me when I hear about homelessness in any country. And when I hear there's been a 452% increase in child homelessness, I am particularly disturbed by that. But as I said, I haven't been to the country to investigate that claim. And to, you know, I need to know more about it. But on its face, I mean, homelessness is prima facie a violation of the right to housing. And so, and it just proof. I mean, homelessness is simply a government that has not effectively implemented the right to housing. That's what that is. And so, I can say that about all government. I mean, there is no place in the world where there is no homelessness. So all governments are in breach. Obviously, it's pretty grave if there's been a 452% increase. I don't know if that's over 10 years or if that's over 5 years or what the timeline is.
It's only, regardless, I think it's only over since 2013.
Deeply
disturbing, right? And and I mean, you don't even need human rights to make that deeply disturbing, right? What do you need to make that deeply disturbing? I mean, that's just like any human being who hears that a huge number of children, or any number of children, frankly, are living in homelessness. That is deeply disturbing, because what does homelessness mean? I mean, the morbidity and mortality rates of people living in homelessness are, you know, obscene, basically. You know, I mean, children contract diseases that would illnesses that would otherwise be completely preventable, you know, respiratory illnesses. If a child gets pneumonia at a young age, they are then susceptible to pneumonia for the rest of their lives. Pneumonia is deadly. You know, like these are facts that can't be denied. You know, the trauma of living on the street or in a car. I've met lots of people living in cars. I've met children living in cars. The trauma of that stays with you for life. And so, you know, if there's, what's the number of children living in homelessness, the increase?
3,821 children as of last month in homelessness.
So almost 4,000 children who are now likely scarred for life. It doesn't mean that they won't bounce back and, you know, have a productive life and all of that stuff. I'm not suggesting that, but I am suggesting that they are scarred for life.
Yeah.
And why are we allowing this? You know,
yeah.
I mean, if you look at where Ireland is on GDP per capita, right? GDP, you're like number two or number one.
Right up the top. And like, depending on what way you want to play our tax status,
right,
we're right at the top.
Exactly. So what is that about? Right. What is that about? And offshore money in the country. I mean, there's all sorts of things that need to be investigated in Ireland, I think, I'm sure all these investigations are going on in country. I think sometimes it can be useful to have an outsider come in and look at what's going on. I would love to have that opportunity at some point, or maybe my successor will.
Yeah.
Yes. That would be great.
Thanks for that, Lilani.
Lastly, because I know you're pushed for time, and I really appreciate you giving the time. The issue of climate change and housing, I think, is getting increased attention. And, you know, we can look at it from a number of angles in terms of, you know, the people have been displaced as a result of climate related, you know, weather changes, issues that are going to be forced into homelessness, and how, you know, our housing systems will deal with this, and also the contribution of our housing system to greenhouse gases, and the potential as well with the idea of the Green New Deal, that, you know, refurbishing, regenerating, rebuilding, and we will build billions of homes, that how could this be done on a low carbon basis? How do you see, or are you seeing, that increased connection between kind of the potential in a way of meeting our climate change targets with meeting the right to housing as well?
Yeah, I mean, you summarized the role of housing and all this very well. I will say, of course, I've seen the impact of climate change on the most vulnerable communities. It tends to be the most vulnerable populations live in the worst housing, the housing that's most susceptible to being, you know, blowing away, washing away, being compromised as a result of climate-related disasters. Obviously, you know, things like tsunamis, flooding, hurricanes, tornadoes, and of course, it's a global situation, whether it's in Texas or whether it's in Jakarta. I'm seeing the same thing happening, which is the displacement of low-income communities and poor communities, often living, as I said, in the most precarious housing. Mm. So that's obviously a real concern. And it's certainly one of the things that has to be looked at when there's this big push on the upgrading of informal settlements, which is also required by the Sustainable Development Goals. So in developing countries around the world, informal settlements are being upgraded, and they need to be upgraded in a way that ensures that those homes are no longer susceptible to the negative effects of climate change-related disasters. One of the things that gets less play is on climate change mitigation of natural disasters and the impact on housing. So I visited communities, particularly in Asia, in the Philippines and Indonesia, which are, you know, the countries that are really affected by climate change and climate change-related disasters. And what I saw happening there is governments taking really seriously this issue of, you know, flooding, for example, and trying to grapple with what they can do to protect their cities from being overwhelmed by flooding. And so what they'll do is they'll say, okay, well, let's build a big concrete wall to keep the tsunami at bay, literally. And what happens when they do that to mitigate is they're displacing communities, because where they want to build that wall, there is an informal settlement. So rather than working with the communities and trying to come up with more natural solutions, which are possible and viable, often mitigation is leading to the displacement of entire communities. I visited one community, I think this was in Jakarta, and I mean, they had come up with this amazing solution. Their houses were apparently too close to the waterfront, and the government wanted to build a big seawall. And so the community said, look, you can build your seawall, fine, but you don't need to displace us. We're going to cut our homes in half. And so they literally took the frontage of their homes off, every home. And that made it such that they were still, you know, they were still able to live in their community, but they were far enough away from the wall and the water to make it a viable and safe place to live, right? Pretty ingenious. In another community, the community member said they didn't need a seawall, but if they just grew more mangroves, the mangroves would act as a natural seawall. And they were still in negotiations when I met them. They were still in negotiations with the government around that. But, you know, I think that's a less talked about issue, but really very, very important. And lastly, I'll say one of the things that I find deeply disturbing is this drive for luxury, you know, the building of luxury accommodation. It's certainly happening in Dublin. I saw all the cranes on the skyline. I see it everywhere I go. Yeah. There is a lot of luxury development, people building mega homes. In North America, we call them monster homes. That still continues. And, of course, that contributes negatively to our climate. And I don't know that that's being talked about so much at the luxury end. I know that we're going to need to build a lot to, you know, meet the Sustainable Development Goals and ensure access to adequate housing and et cetera. But I don't want us to only target the building that's happening at the low end. Let's also target our discussions and our actions around building that's happening at that upper end.
Absolutely. No, that's a very good point. Leilani, thanks so much for joining us. And hopefully we can chat again before your term comes to an end.
I sure hope so.
Yes. I keep up the great work.
Thanks, you too.
Leilani, it's
pleasure
great.
Pleasure to talk with you guys.
You're an absolute star for giving us your time, and we admire you from afar, the work that you do. It really keeps even people as cynical and as washed up as Rory, it keeps them going, you know?
Thanks so much. And you guys inspire me too, so keep doing what you're doing.
You're very kind. Thanks, Leilani.
Thanks.
Talk to you soon. Take care.
No problem. Bye.